bear jackets that the Eau Claire Bears wore. And on their left sleeve, they had their uniform numbers. Mm-hmm. And I had AR on mine. And
so when you were, was this at your home or was this at...
No, that was at Mr. Bazanson's house. Rand Bazanson was the president of the ball club and very active. He was there all the time. A good boss. He really liked me. And his son is only 10 years younger than I am.
Yeah.
And I babysat him when I was only 14 years old, and something like that even.
Yeah.
How could they have trusted me, you know, with their kid, you know? And at that time, you didn't even think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, you know, boy, when you start having kids of your own, and but they never question anything.
Hey, my kid, my son is going to be 14 in April, and there's no way in heck I trust him with somebody else's.
Yeah, just amazing.
Well, that's at the concession?
Yeah, this is the door that goes out into the hallway there. And that's the near beer. The near beer was bad stuff.
Okay.
Because we couldn't, at that time, couldn't sell beer, alcohol of any kind.
Oh, you couldn't even do the low?
Oh, no. And so near beer was sold. And that's where Joe Bender reached over and tried to open up that door, and I slapped him.
Well, who made the, who, what, do you remember what company made the near beer? Or?
Well, yeah, I think it was Walters. Walters or Liney's, it was made in Eau Claire, I know that. Those were the cases for it there.
It was all bottle, right?
Yeah. How would you have thought I could pick out the month and year of that date?
You can see the Wednesday, the 26th.
Yeah, but that's all you can see on there.
I don't know.
Had to be, unless you knew the people behind you were only there for a set day.
No, I had to use a perpetual calendar to find out what date that was. Because I knew that it couldn't have been in 48 and 49 because we didn't have those fancy coolers.
Oh, okay. That's where you had the cow...
Yeah,
drinking.
Those big cow barrels, car troughs, and
yeah, I know my uncle has them still.
It was ugly. Yeah. I have pop in there, and
well, that's mm-hmm. the way they. When we used to down where I'm from, we used to have the 4th of July. They have that, and they'd still do it that way. You know, throw all the soda pop right. And oh, get the popcorn going.
Yeah, we had a gigantic popcorn machine. Boy, that thing could whip out the popcorn. That was great. And so you see that I was working during the day. I had a mop in my hand from time to time and pop in my hands. And
the old 1950s look, the white t-shirt with the blue jeans.
Yeah, right, sure. And that was the back door of the concession stand. And it's too bad I didn't have the years on there. That's just a picture of me on the steps of St. Pat's Church.
I look back, my dad had a haircut like that when he was that age.
And do you know who that guy is?
I know, but I can't. I know. I once you tell me, I'm gonna figure. I know who it is.
I don't know.
Played for the Twins.
I don't even know the Twins.
I know the Twins.
He's in the Hall of Fame.
What's his name?
Armin Killebrew.
Yes, Killebrew. Yep. Yeah, they got a big. At the Mall of America, where the Metropolitan Stadium used to be, where he hit the home run that.
That. The chair that the ball hit. The chair is up on the wall, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think it's a red seated chair. Or,
it's like one of the like the ones that they used to have at County Stadium.
Yeah. That's that Chuck Tanner.
He's over in there.
Yeah, they were. Geez, those guys were great. To know them and to have them give 13, 14-year-olds some recognition, you know. It just, this is the 48 Bears. That's the first year that I worked with there. That's the John Malone there.
Oh, there's John Malone.
Okay. He always got on my case for calling Pop, Pop.
He wanted
my
soda?
My grandma calls it Pop. My cousins would call it Pop.
In Boston, it's Tonic.
What's Tonic?
He That's said, funny. Alpha, you've got to call that Tonic. I said, Mr. Malone, I'm not in Boston, you know. And this is the 51 Bears.
How many years did you work the concession stand there?
From 1948 to the ending of the 53 season.
So you were there when they, wasn't it 53 they took the pennant?
Or 51.
51 they took the pennant.
Big crowds that year. Over 100,000 people showed up over the course of the year.
Did they?
And,
oh, go ahead.
And all those managers were such nice guys. They just treated you so fatherly, you know. Is that on?
Yeah.
Andy Cohen was an older man, Jewish. He managed there 48, 49, 50. And he would, from time to time, when they were out batting practice, I would assume maybe he was hitting fungos. Fungos, a baseball is hit with a very small circular bat that sent that ball as a fly ball. Fungo, they call it fungo. I don't know where fungo comes from. But I think that's what he did. And he would get a Charlie horse up in his upper thigh, you know. And he would come limping in and, Arthur, get out here, help me, and so on, come on. Down to his office he would go, and he would put two chairs together, and he would sit in one, and he would put his leg on the other one. Mm-hmm. Arthur, grab that bat. And I would grab that bat, and he said, okay, now, hit me right here with that bat. And Dorothy was in the front office, and she would sneak around the corner and look. And he said, hit me a good one. And I'd grab that bat, come up and hit him. And, gotta hit me a little harder, Arthur. When you think about it, you could get a blood clot. You know? And it wasn't only when I got into x-ray, I thought, oh man, I was hitting that guy's leg with a bat, you know? And all of a sudden he would get up and fine, thanks, Arthur. And back to the field he would go, you know? And then Bill Adair came, Bill Adair. Oh, Andy Cohen, was assigned to the New York Giants in He was second baseman. And this had to have been in the 30s. I wish I knew the years. But the manager of the Giants was a guy by the name of John McGraw, who was, when you read stories about him, he was one tough cookie. He was a tyrant. And he was Irish, obviously. And he hated Jews. I mean, that was common knowledge. He hated Jews. Well, Andy Cohen was on his team. And the story, obviously, is that John McGraw couldn't do anything about it because he doesn't sign ball players. The club signs ball players, and they gave him Andy Cohen. You know, you take him and like him or not. Well, and John McGraw's second baseman got hurt, and he reluctantly had to call in a Jew, Andy Cohen. Andy told me this story, and he said, I only played a couple of games, but John wouldn't say a word to me. And just ignored me, you know. And he said, boy, when you're on a ball club and your manager ignores you and makes it a point to know that he's ignoring you, you know, that gets kind of tough. But, you know, at my age, I didn't realize the struggle that must have taken place with this John McGraw. And then years later, when you read about it, here it's true, you know. And if you ever watch, who is that guy that made those tremendous documentaries? He made that tremendous documentary on baseball. It covers six or seven.
Burns,
yeah.
Was Ken Burns? Yeah.
Ken Burns. Well, he tells that story.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
About Andy Cohen, you know, and man, oh man, you know, and, I knew him, you know, and gee whiz. Oh, great. And that's the... that guy there is Gordy Roach. That made a big hit.
I was reading about it because that was one of the questions I was going to ask you, because I was like, I was reading about him being the pitcher.
Yeah.
And I was going to ask you, and it's like, after looking it up, it's like I figured it out, it wasn't related to
you. No, he's from Canada.
Yep. Who is this here, then?
That would be Horace Garner, I think. Horace Garner. Where's Roach? Yeah, Garner. Horace Garner. And that's that Chet Morgan. She's a nice guy. But I think Horace Garner was... we had one ball player there. Black ball player. Played first base. And what position does Garner play there?
Outfield.
So it couldn't have been him. But this black first baseman, gee, I wish I could remember his name. He had feet like battleships. They were humongous. And there was one game in which he tried to field a ground ball, and he steps on his own hand.
I think I read that somewhere, that story. I read it somewhere. I don't know where, but...
You know. Yeah.
They were wearing cleats back then, weren't they?
Yes, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to live through those days to to prove that they existed, you know, and happened. And here in Eau Claire, we had a guy by the name of Ham Olive, and I think that was his name. That's the only name we knew him by, Ham Olive. He was originally a House of David ball player. If you know anything about the House of David, was kind of a religion of some kind, but they had a tremendous baseball club. And they all had long beards and things. And Ham Olive played on that team. And they had come to Eau Claire from time to time. That they were still in existence in the 50s because I watched them play. And Ham ended up here in Eau Claire. And this is where he lived and died here. He worked for the White's Machine shop. But he was an umpire. Great umpire. Oh, man, he could umpire like you wouldn't believe. But in those days, they had those big air-filled chest protectors. And he would always wear that. Well, the Fargo Moorhead twins. Yeah, the Fargo Moorhead twins. Had a manager by the name of Bruno Haas. A big, fat, old guy. He maybe was a good ball player at one time, but as a manager, I don't think you could bend down and pick up a ball. He was just big. But he and Ham couldn't tell you the time of day if they were looking at the same clock. They just simply didn't get along. No matter what. And occasionally, Ham was umpiring here in Eau Claire when the Fargo Moorhead Twins played. And it was something. Because the first pitch generally came down, and all of a sudden, they were at it. You know? And one day, Ham Olive threw him out. And I was working in the concession stand, and I could hear these cleats come down the concrete. And here it was, Bruno Haas came up to the concession stand and said, "Sonny, do you have one of those big wicker baskets?" I said, "No. Why would you want one of those?" "Well," he said, "I would just like one." Well, I said, "Go across the hall to the vendors. They've got one. Connie Chumas would give you one." He went over there. Sure enough, he cleats, walked past the concession stand with his great big wicker basket. What's he going to do with that, you know? Well, all of a sudden, you heard the crowd go wild. Absolutely wild. They were cheering and laughing, and so I tore out of the concession stand and went up and there was Bruno Haas walking through the grandstand with his big wicker basket selling ham sandwiches with olives. You know, it drove the fans crazy. And Ham Olive turned around. Because he couldn't help but hear this. And it was too much. Even a saint had to turn around. And there was Ham Olive. He looked up. And he pointed to Bruno Haas as if I could throw you out up there, I would. And you know, some of those nights were unbelievable. Man, that was a great experience up there.
Did they have a lot of night games, or was it more day
games?
Oh,
they were mostly all night games.
All the time?
Yeah, they were all night games. Doubleheaders, can't remember exactly when they started. I think 6:30 or something like that. Occasionally you would have a Sunday game, but not too many times.
And, people come up to Carson and picnic out around there at all during, like,
Saturday? In those days, no. No, there wasn't any, what we would call today tailgating. There wasn't any of that. But they just came out to watch the ball game and left. And you have to picture Carson Park in those days. It was dark. They didn't have street lights coming up and going out. And I sometimes had to walk home, of course, because in high school, my parents had a house down Shawtown, and Shawtown was not the best part of Eau Claire. People stayed away from Shawtown.
People still stay away from Shawtown.
they maybe do. I don't know why. But Shawtown has a name for itself. The police, well, Shawtown produced three chief of polices, and the police never came down there. I don't think the police knew where Shawtown was. But we had three chief of polices. One lived right across the street from my Uncle Frank. So, you know, how do you account for that? But, you know, sometimes I would walk home and, oh, man, through that dark Carson Park. And, yeah, it was...
Did they have that back entrance back then, or was it just the front entrance up there to get into Carson Park?
Oh, you had both ends.
You had both ends to get into...
Grand Avenue and... Menominee Street, yeah. So
I was going to ask you, did you get to go on any road trips or anything with the team at all, or?
We went once up to Duluth Superior. They only played one game up there, a makeup game, and it could have been two games because we stayed up there one night. Dorothy Wall. Her sister worked in the concession stand with me, and her other sister's husband was a ticket taker. And Dorothy and her family and I, they brought me along. We went up to Duluth to watch that game. Well, in the Duluth a ballpark, the players told me that all summer the outfield was wet, soggy, because the sun apparently just didn't dry that, you know. And they said, yeah, Duluth was a different place to play. Well, our hotel faced the lake, and this was in July. And I saw these big hunks of white out in the lake, and they were quite a ways from shore, but you could distinctly tell they were white. And I brought that up with Dorothy, and well, I don't know what they are, and somebody down asked the desk clerk, I guess, what those white things were out in the lake. Well, that's ice. It's July. What are you talking about? It's ice. It's ice. Oh, man. Glad to be back in Eau Claire, you know. And yeah, we only got up there once to watch a ball game. Because I had to stay and clean the concession stand and recount after every the beginning of every road trip and at the end of the home stand, you you counted verbatim the bottles during a homestand. It was a guess because you used the empty bottle containers as the count, and you were pretty accurate. If there were an exceptional amount of breakage, you had to kind of remember all that stuff. But then when they went on the road, you counted them bottle by bottle, and made out a very distinct a report, and that included candy and things. And across the hall from the concession stand were two cigarette machines. That was owned by a Ben Siriani, who had a confectionery business, and we bought our candy from him. And these cigarette machines, a package of cigarettes was 20 cents. And a Canadian quarter would button up that machine. I mean, you maybe didn't even have to put in that Canadian quarter, and that machine knew that it was history, you know, and they would button that thing up. And they would always come to the concessions that, you owe me 20 cents. What do I owe you 20 cents for? Well, that machine took my 20 cents, didn't pay me back. We don't own those machines. They don't belong to me. They don't belong to us. They belong to Ben Siriani. Well, call them. Well, I'm not going to call them. We're working, you know. And then during the day, I would call him, and Ben, okay, I'll be up. And he would come up and fix them. And one day he came up and knocked on the concession stand door. Artie, he said, would you think about doing me a favor? Well, yeah, Ben, what's your problem? He said, well, if I showed you how to fix those machines, would you do it for me? I said, well, I couldn't do it when I'm working. Now, obviously, if I had a chance, I would, but I couldn't guarantee doing it right that night because, we are working, you know. But during the day I would then, and then I'd go and fix it. And he said, and by the way, take as many cigarettes as you want. And, I guess when I think about it, I really took him for a ride because I had cigarettes. I had a lot of them. And I even had enough for my brother, but he never said anything,
I figured he opened the door, so. Yeah,
and when the season ended, I could pretty much judge, if there's 10 games left, I could pretty much judge how much, how many bags of peanuts there would be left. And, gum, and candy bars, and things. And I got actually pretty good at knowing that if I don't open a box of peanuts, they would go back. But an open one, they wouldn't take. And we had Fisher's peanuts in those little 10-cent bags. And, oh, man, those things were good. They were as fresh as could be. It's like eating a peanut. You can't eat just one. You got to have 25. And so toward the end of the season, I would make sure that I had a goodly amount of peanuts and gum. Mm-hmm. And I would buy it for what the ball club paid for it, which was, sometimes they even, just go ahead and get them out of here. You know? Well, during my high school days, every day I had a bag of peanuts. And my friends couldn't figure out where I got those peanuts. Mm-hmm. And I always had gum. And always a candy bar, you know. And they finally figured out, well, are you stealing those things from the bomb? Like, no, no, no. And man, during the school year, I had my supply of peanuts and gum for the whole year, you know. Well, that was a lot of fun doing, figuring out things like that, you know, and going through the bother of thinking you're smart, you know, and things like
that. When you were with the city of Eau Claire, with, you know, you had the, like you're saying, the Buick dealership, and did any of the players kind of like go work for them and try and sell product or help with advertising at all?
No, the general manager, or the business manager, generally was, he came in town sometime in, March. And, to start learning the town and going out and get advertising for the scorecard. And we would, in those days you could buy an 16 millimeter copy of the previous autumn's World Series, and the ball club generally always had one, and we would go out to little towns like Durand, Mondovi, Fall Creek, Augusta, Menominee, Colfax, Chippewa, and we would have an evening in which we would show the World Series, because, you know, there wasn't television, and and the only way you got to know or hear about the World Series was listening to it on radio. And we did that when the business manager came in, because he would learn the town and he would talk about the Bears, you know. We'd like to have you come and watch the, it looks like we're going to have a great season, you know, blah this and blah that. And so we would take those big Bear cars and drive them around, you know. And they were Chryslers, 9 passengers. They had a middle fold down seat between the two big cushion ones. And they were just simply dogs. In those years, I think Chrysler called those engines a fluid drive. They sounded like a tank. And you could shift them or you could use them automatically. If you shifted them, you had to have some kind of coordination without that engine blowing up, because if it was in low, you didn't have to go very far until that engine started to roar as if it was going to blow up. And then you have to shift it up into second. And it was the same thing with second. You could only go so far, so fast with that. And then that engine would just roar, you know, and you'd bring it down. Or you could do it all automatically, you know. I think they were straight eights, and oh man, they were dogs. And we would drive those things, and yeah, Dorothy would get a call, and Well, somebody's driving your car that's going a little too fast on Barstow Street or something like that. And believe it or not, I could get those long Chrysler cars pretty much in a normal parking spot. Mm-hmm. And I had people stand on the sidewalk and watch this. And I would get that car in there. And I would get out in here as this young snip driving that car and doing what he did. And they would look at me as if, who in the heck do you think you are, you little snip, you know? And, well, that was so much fun to drive those cars. And I would bring it home. Before the game, I would hope to try to come home and change clothes and get into something where you're dealing with the public, you know, because during the day you're in that T-shirt and old slacks, you know, and then you try to go home and get a shirt on or something like that, you know. But I would occasionally take one of those home and park it in front of the house. The people across Birch Street turned out to be Jerry Poling's mother and dad. Jerry Poling is the man who wrote
Somewhere Up North.
And Jerry was just a baby. Mm-hmm. And when I first met Jerry, Jerry said, well, I know you. And, I don't know you. How could you know me? Huh? So I knew you when I was a kid. And so then he told me, and wow. Yeah, he said, my mom used to talk about that big black Eau Claire Bears car coming up there and that young snip coming out of there driving that. That was your parents? Yeah, that was my parents. And oh, wow.
If you had one thing that just stands out about Eau Claire during the 50s, what would it be?
I would say the tremendous amount of kids my age who was always at the ball games. Yeah, during the day they would maybe swim and things I couldn't do because I was working. But they were up there from time to time when the ball players were batting, batting practice. But they were up there during the games. Carson Park was the place to be. Today, I suppose it's the amusement parks or the video things at the mall, or maybe the mall in general. But in the early 50s, it was Carson Park. It was a ball club. They were up there during the ball games, and my brother got a job in the scoreboard. The scoreboard was a manual operating thing. You had to, if they didn't score a run, you had a big tin plate that had zero on it, and you'd hook it up and things, they would from time to time goofing around in there and not paying attention, you know. All of a sudden, a one wouldn't go up, and wait a minute, you know, they didn't score a run, you know. And Ralph Gooding. I think he pronounced his name Gooding or Godding. But he had a real baritone voice, you know, perfect for announcing. You could plug your ears and you could still hear him. The Bears didn't get a run this inning. Down, up goes a zero, you know.
So Gooding was pretty much the announcer during that time?
Yeah. Yeah, this is... that's him right there.
Ah.
And that's Dorothy Wall, the secretary, and that's me. And that's Jim Trimble, who worked out in the scoreboard with my brother and my cousin. And these are the other girls that worked in the concession stand. And these are all the board of directors, or at least some of them. And these are the ticket takers and people like that. And where's Wally Rudd, the policeman? He's someplace here.
He would be right there.
Okay, the policeman and things. Yeah, that was pretty neat. There was a man who took tickets, real tall, skinny guy. He had to been in his 80s when I worked there, and name was Russ Bailey. And my dad came to a few of the ball games, but not too many. He would come in. They would allow him to come in because I worked there, I guess. But he knew Russ Bailey, this old guy. And my dad told me one time, he said, you know, I watched that Russ Bailey play baseball up at the old ballpark before Carson Park was built. And my dad said he was one of the finest ball players you ever wanted to watch. Center fielder. My dad said he could cover center field like a squirrel. And he was the nicest guy. He always liked me, and I didn't even know him, you know. And, well, Artie, how are you doing, you know, and stuff like that. And here he was, a great ball player, and those guys couldn't afford to make the majors or pro football.
They got some visitors.
That's John Malone and Andy Cohen there.